From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. How do you define intelligence, and what's the goal of defining it? Our society has an ugly history in terms of how it's answered these questions, hiding away the so-called feeble-minded in institutions or special schools where they languished. This approach was blown up in the 1960s and 70s thanks to the disabilities rights movement. However, inclusion of people with intellectual disabilities is still not the norm in many schools and most workplaces. But what happens when it is the norm? That's the story told by a new documentary from New Hampshire filmmaker Dan Habib. It's called Intelligent Lives, and it just started its national tour, making its Granite State debut on Monday in Concord. Today in The Exchange, redefining intelligence, the themes in this film and a companion film about one New Hampshire school, Conville High in Peterborough. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have four guests for the hour. Dan Habib is here, filmmaker at UNH's Institute on Disability. In addition to the film we're going to talk about, Dan is creator of the award-winning documentaries, including Samuel, Who Cares About Kelsey, and Mr. Connolly Has ALS. And Dan, a big welcome back. Nice to see you.
Thanks for having us, Laura.
Joining us by phone from Massachusetts, Marianne Leone, executive producer of Intelligent Lives, author of the 2010 book Jesse, A Mother's Story about her son who had cerebral palsy and epilepsy. Marianne's husband, actor Chris Cooper, narrates the film, and the two of them founded the Jesse Cooper Foundation. And Marianne, really nice to have you. Thank you also for taking time out. Marianne, can you hear me? Okay, we must have a problem with Marianne's connection. I'm sure she'll be up with us soon. Our other guests are Garrett Shows, a student at Conval High School, where he also serves on the Student Principal Advisory Committee. Garrett participates in unified sports. He works part-time at Shaw's. Garrett was born 3 months premature and has some developmental disabilities. And Garrett, it's really nice of you to be here. Thank you so much. Also with us, Dan Shows, Garrett Shows' father. The family is in Peterborough. And Dan, thank you also for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and Dan Habib, I want to start with you. These films, both of them, the one about Garrett and Conval and Intelligent Lives, which is just debuting in Concord on Monday, as I said, right off the bat, they take aim at IQ tests. How come, Dan?
Well, everything I do in film work really grows out of my experience with my son, Samuel. Samuel is a high school senior here in Concord, at Concord High School. He's been on the honor roll much of the time. He's very active in sports. He's got a great social life, extracurricular life. He also has cerebral palsy, uses a wheelchair and a communication device. And thankfully, in our community, I think people have high expectations for him and believe he can succeed in school, believe he can go on to college. But often when we're out in society, people talk to him like he's a four-year-old or a five-year-old just because he moves through the world in a non-traditional way. So about 5 or 6 years ago when I was doing Who Cares About Kelsey, the dean of education at Syracuse, Doug Bicklin, said to me, Dan, if you could ever do a film that really looked at our notions of how we perceive intelligence, that would be such a contribution to society, because that is probably the biggest barrier for people with disabilities is perceptions of intelligence. So I started doing research and found that unfortunately, people with intellectual disabilities are the most segregated group of Americans.
Really?
Yeah.
The most.
I mean, only 17% of these students go to regular schools and classrooms. And as adults, only 15% will be employed. And a lot of that stems from perceptions of intelligence that are supposed to be measures of intelligence, like the IQ test or SAT scores or standardized testing. And I think the real premise of this film is, can any measure of intelligence predict a person's value or their ability to contribute meaningfully to the world? So the film really examines how we perceive and try to measure these ideas of intelligence.
Well, and a lot of characters in the film talk about this idea of IQ tests and how they're still given and how they've been put it, you know, for lack of a better word, abused, Dan, right?
Right. I mean, it started out, Alfred Binet, who you may know from the Binet-Simon IQ test, he was a French psychologist who actually designed the test to identify kids that needed extra help. It wasn't a way to say, oh, this is your intelligence for the rest of your life. But unfortunately, in the early 1900s in this country, IQ testing was used to institutionalize hundreds of thousands of people. It even led to the forced sterilization of 60,000 people in this country. And it really, to this day, people are still living in institutions and in segregated settings. settings based largely on this measure of intelligence called the IQ test. And in fact, 49 out of 50 states, including New Hampshire, still use IQ testing as a way to determine whether someone has this label called intellectual disability, which isn't a diagnosis. It's just this collection of symptoms per se. And it's very limiting to a lot of people to have this number attached to them for their whole life.
Well, and Marianne Leone, I want to play a little clip from the film where your husband, Intelligent Lives narrator Chris Cooper, talks about your son Jesse's school insisting on an IQ test when Jesse was young. So let's hear.
The test contained absurd, antiquated questions like, Jesse, do you dust a dresser? And Marianne and I are thinking, dust? My wife and I don't dust. We call dressers bureaus. And anyway, dusting wasn't a chore I had thought to give to my child with quadriplegia.
Again, that's Intelligent Lives narrator Chris Cooper, and his wife Marianne Leone joins us. She's executive producer of the film we're looking at, Intelligent Lives. And Marianne, can you just talk a little bit more about that experience, how you and your husband's eyes were first open to IQ testing?
Well, you know, we were fighting the school because they were denying him his basic right to a free and appropriate public education. And they wanted to ship him off somewhere when he was 6 years old. So he was in a room for 2 hours with no break. And his tutor came out afterwards and asked me for a cigarette. And I said, you don't smoke. And she said, and that's how I knew how badly it went. She said there had been no adaptations for his disability whatsoever. In other words, Jesse had one volitional movement, which was a raking grasp. And they didn't adapt anything for him. So in the end, basically, they spent a lot of money, and to their credit, they drew no conclusions for that one. But they blew money on this thing that was ridiculous. When he was finally tested with a computer adapted to his ability, he scored in the 99th percentile.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the point your husband makes, I mean, it's just, you know, dusting a dresser is not something I would ask my son with quadriplegia to do. I mean, it makes you realize how ill-adapted these tests are. Dan Schoes, your family went through this too. I want to play a clip from the film about Garrett where your wife talks about this.
When Garrett was in elementary school, they brought in a MR, representative of mental retardation specialist, because they had to give him an IQ test. It was part of like whatever process we were in, and he did not score well. He scored in the MR category, and they were trying to put that label on him.
So, Dan, how did that feel to have them come back and give you that MR category, mental retardation?
Well, it hurts. You know, one of the reasons why we ended up here in New Hampshire is we were in Georgia at the time. That's where Garrett was born, and they had no inclusion in the schools there. We sought out New Hampshire because there was inclusion at the time. So as we go through the process, that was one of the data points that was created for Garrett. And no individual, in addition to this population, should be cornholed and held to one data point, and that's going to be a descriptive of what their capabilities are.
Well, and it seems like, and Marianne, you and your husband talk about this in the film, you know, we know now that there's multiple intelligences. To just ascribe a number to somebody and say, this is your intelligence, I mean, it just seems kind of crazy, right?
I faced a lot of eye rolling from people, but I knew he was intelligent from when he was a baby, and he laughed appropriately at silly things. But, you know, I got a lot of eye rolls until there was definite proof via some test, which isn't right. And the same thing happened, by the way, with the MCAS testing, where a portfolio assessment is what makes sense. They actually did not know how to test him for that. And had Jesse lived, we might have been facing a thing where they wouldn't give him an actual diploma, even though he was on the honor roll every single time.
What is MCAS, by the way, Marianne? What is that?
Excuse me?
You said something about the MCAS testing. What is that?
You know, I don't know what the acronym stands for because it's been a long time
Sure.
since I've been in the trenches, but it's a test that is taken in order to get your diploma. I don't know. I mean,
it's standardized testing in Massachusetts.
Sure. Okay, yeah. So, Garrett, let's bring you in.
Yes, ma'am.
How would you describe yourself?
I would describe myself as hardworking and hardworking, never give up, always striving more than myself, I was striving more to be great. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
How old are you, Garrett?
I'm 19 years old.
Yeah. Are you graduating from high school this year?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Yeah, so a little bit later in the show, we'll talk about what you hope to do afterwards. What do you wish people, Garrett, knew or understood about you?
I don't really understand the question, I'm sorry.
What is it that you think people don't understand about you when they don't know you like your family and friends?
Okay.
We spoke about this yesterday when we were preparing for the program.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the things that Garrett struggles with is memory. So he has a lot of trouble with working memory. And, you know, when you talk about the disabled population in general, it runs the gambit from scale zero all the way up to 1,000. And some folks you can physically look at and tell that they're disabled and the struggles that they do. Garrett, somewhere in the middle, after you're with him, you can see processing issues that he has, memory issues that he has. And I think one of the things that we kind of talked about yesterday was, so I think some people don't understand his birth history. Like, you, if you were to approach him in 2 minutes, you may not know that he's disabled. Just like you look at other people in population, you don't know what they're carrying. And one of the things the most devastating thing was his birth history. He was 2.5 pounds when he was born, and we ran the gambit of all of the issues that a 3-month premature baby would have, which is significant.
Well, and you're brave to come on the radio, Garrett, given your memory issues, and you were up front with us. You know, you said, look, there may be times when I just don't remember the answer. So that's really okay. That's really all right. I want to invite our listeners to join us as well. There's so much that we need to talk about this hour, and we'd love to get your questions and comments in. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. Today in Exchange, we're looking at two films, one brand new, one came out in recent years. Both of them look at the idea of this concept of intelligence and challenge our perception of people with intellectual disabilities. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Dan, the film Intelligent Lives shows us, and you alluded to this earlier, some pretty ugly footage of institutions where families were told they should put their children. Marianne alluded to this earlier. She was told that she should do that. When did this system really start to blow up, and who blew it up?
Well, it started with parents, you know, as much as society in terms of disability rights, special education. In the 1950s, parents became mobilized and activated, and they started pushing back. And, you know, you had a very important leader in our country, John F. Kennedy, who had a sister with intellectual disability, Rosemary, who was actually institutionalized at that point. But her family, John F. Kennedy, and particularly Eunice Kennedy Shriver, his sister, started the Special Olympics, started to shift the way that we perceive people with disabilities. But for a while, it just stayed more of a parent movement. In the late 1960s and 70s, people with disabilities took over the movement for themselves, and they pushed for things like the Americans with Disabilities Act, the right to a free and appropriate education through the IDEA. And that's really since the 70s and 80s, things started to change. Now, unfortunately, these fights are still going on all over the country. You know, I travel a lot, and there are kids with disabilities who are being systemically segregated all over the country, in fact, more so than being included. So it's not like this is ancient history. There's still a very much an ongoing struggle for inclusion in all aspects of life, especially for people with intellectual disabilities.
Well, and the film does have an example of that, and we'll talk about that in a minute. One of the young people profiled, Naomi, was at sort of a place that was called a school but wasn't really a school. But you alluded to the 1960s, the Kennedy family, and there's a great clip in the film Intelligent Lives, an interview with Robert F. Kennedy after an institution called Willowbrook was shut down. Let's just hear.
I visited the state institutions for the mentally retarded, and I think particularly at Willowbrook that we have a situation that borders on a snake pit, that the children live in filth, that many of our fellow citizens are suffering tremendously because lack of attention, lack of imagination, lack of adequate manpower.
So again, that's a clip from the film Intelligent Lives. That was Robert F. Kennedy talking about the closure of an institution called Willowbrook. And wow, Marianne, some pretty dramatic language there, you know, a snake pit. But at the end, he talks about a lack of imagination and a lack of manpower. How much do you still see that going on today?
I opened up my newsletter from Disability Scoop this morning. It says, caregiver shortage forcing young people with disabilities into institutions. It's still happening.
Yeah, I mean, Marianne's battle that she shares in her book with Jesse to get him included in school, they had to fight very hard to get access for him, and she can, you know, allude to that. But unfortunately, those battles are still happening. This is ancient history. So I don't know, Marianne, if you wanted to share anything about that, but it's incredible what you did to get Jesse included.
Go ahead, Marianne.
Well, I mean, we have resources, so I don't think it's that incredible. My mentor was Mary Somoza, who had twin daughters with cerebral palsy, who lived in an apartment in New York below the poverty line, two wheelchairs, two sets of stairs, and still fought, got her daughters into school. Both of them graduated. One of them went pre-law to Georgetown, the other one and then went on to get her master's from the London School of Economics. The other is now an artist. They are both productive members of society. And I believe that a lot of the problem with Jesse was because he was nonverbal. And Dan, you can speak to this. When you're nonverbal, people assume all kinds of things. And this happens to elderly people in the population who have a stroke. So, right. You know, all of us, the disabled population calls all of us temporarily abled with good reason.
Right.
And it's something we should all be concerned about, whether or not it's in our family.
Yeah, and I think that's why I went to Convale High School, because I think it's so important to show the problems, which we show in the film, the challenges, but it's also important to show the successes. And Garrett's experience at Convale is really, I think, a model for what we should be doing all over the country. And maybe Garrett can talk about this, but you know, Garrett is doing an internship in a gym class there with a mentor. He's working in the community. He's included in general education. He's doing unified sports. And so, you know, Garrett's experience there, I think, is shows that this can work for students with all disabilities. They can be fully included in high school and on a path towards a regular diploma.
Garrett, why don't you tell us a little bit more about that? You know, what some of the things are you do at school besides just attending classes?
Sure. I do homework for one that I'm not necessarily proud of, but I have to do it to get smarter.
Yeah.
One of them is going, I have some trouble with directions, so I don't know particularly where this class is or this class is or whatever. That I'm going to, but I do a pretty good job. That's why I have my phone to remind myself, oh, I have to go this way or I have to go that way. So,
can I ask Garrett about one thing? So, yeah. You know, a lot of people with disabilities, the kids have individualized education plans and you have these meetings that you come to. Can you talk about leading your own meeting, which is in the film?
Yeah, the IEP. It was pretty amazing because, and I think I'm going to do it again because you got to have the responsibility of leading your own meeting, talk about what you want to talk about. Of course, the whole team has to agree, but at the end of the day, you have to talk about what you want to talk about, and it's just amazing.
Well, and we should talk after a short break about what those meetings are about, including you, Dan, shows what it's like to participate and, you know, letting the reins go and letting Garrett manage it, take control of it. We have a lot more to cover, too. Some of the themes that come up in both of these films, especially as these young adults sort of graduate from high school and head into college and head into the workplace. There's some pretty amazing stories there as well. And we'll take your calls. We haven't forgotten about that. 1-800-892-6477. Got a couple emails, too, to share with you. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org.
Big things are happening at NHPR. We're expanding local news coverage.
But St. Anselm isn't the only New Hampshire school getting political attention.
And evolving our programs to reach more listeners like
down
you.
Our website, outsideinradio.org.
And you are at the heart of these endeavors. It's why we created NHPR's Campaign for Innovation. Your ever-evolving needs as a listener inspire us to prepare for the future of NHPR today. Learn more at nhprinnovation.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, how do we define intelligence and why does it matter? Two documentaries from a New Hampshire filmmaker challenge our perception of people with intellectual disabilities. We're talking with those who created these films and those whose stories, struggles, and triumphs are portrayed. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, with your own stories and questions. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Jenny in Barrington. She says, thank you for doing the show. My aunt was born in the 50s with developmental disabilities, and my grandparents, Joe and Betty, were among the first wave of parent activists who helped to found the Great Bay School and shut down Laconia, which was a horrific institution, Jenny says. She says, I actually devoted my graduate research to showing how IQ tests were used at the Vermont Industrial School to exclude children, isolate and eventually sterilizing them 100 years ago. Jenny says, I am horrified that 100 years later, we're still using these tests to exclude people who can easily live independently and be productive and wonderful members of the community. And Dan Habib, I think in the film you say, yeah, we are still using these.
Yeah. Let me say that there are some things, there's some knowledge you can gain through these, what might be called cognitive assessments or intelligence tests. I mean, you know, Samuel at one point, he has a very significant math disability. And so at one point we said, listen, we want to understand why he has this math disability. So a couple years ago, we actually went through this assessment and I said to them, I do not want any numbers attached to this. I just want to understand what is Samuel's math disability. And it was like Marianne described, it was a very painful and didn't feel like a very productive process, but they determined some things that help us understand his math problems. But if I had ever gotten a number attached to that stuck with Samuel for the rest of his life, I would have felt awful. And the reality is that there are now alternatives to assessing students' needs beyond IQ testing. There's something called the support intensity scale. And all they do is they measure what are the supports you need in order to be fully included in society. And it was a really productive experience that we went through about a year ago with Samuel. So it's I think we're over-relying on the IQ test because it's kind of what we know and what we have. But we need to really shake it up and think about different ways of doing business.
Well, and the approach that you just described, Dan, I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, wow, that would help everybody.
Exactly. It's like, I mean, we all need supports.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the bottom line, is that everyone needs supports in society. You know, people with intellectual disabilities or any disability are not different in that way. And I think the really important thing for people to understand is that there's 30 years of research that says when students with disabilities of all kinds are included in general education, they have better outcomes in employment, in higher education, in their social lives, in their behavior, in their communication. So if the research is absolutely clear that this is going to be better for kids with disabilities, why aren't we including everyone? And that's kind of the heart of my work.
Well, and maybe because schools think it's expensive, it's a pain in the neck, it's a burden,
It's not necessarily more expensive, I'll say that. It's really a matter of leadership. The districts in New Hampshire that have superintendents and principals that believe in inclusion, like at Conval, like in Concord, they're doing inclusion. In districts where you don't have that kind of leadership, it may not be happening. And it's not necessarily that these districts have more money. I was down filming in Mississippi, in the Mississippi Delta, one of the poorest communities in the country, and they were doing inclusion beautifully well. In a community that has about a $19,000 a year family median income, 100% African American, 100% free and reduced lunch. So you can't say it's about resources when they're doing it in Mississippi.
What's the attitude Dan shows at Conval?
We've had a great experience there. You know, this IQ test issue reverberates with Dan. It reverberates with Arlene and I. And it reverberates with Chris Cooper in the film. This is one data point. As humans, we're a lot more complicated than that. And in regards to Garrett's IEP at the school, and we're all different. We all learn differently, whether you have a disability or not. And if you want to get down to brass tacks, every student at a school needs his own individualized education plan because every student learns differently. And unfortunately, most of the systems are set up as a one-size-fits-all, and it doesn't really work that way.
Sure. I've still got a picture of myself sitting in the back of algebra class in ninth grade crying because I didn't get it. I just didn't get it. And the teacher didn't get why I didn't get it. So that would have been helpful for me.
We've seen immense growth in this area, but when we think we're so advanced as a society, but when I was in service in Maine, I remember in 1993, my squadron volunteered at one of these state homes, and it didn't dawn on me what that was at the time. I was uneducated. Now I'm a little bit more educated. That was in 1993. That was not a far time from now.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Lots of people want to jump into our conversation, so let's go to them. And Abby's calling from Greenfield. Hi, Abby. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is for Garrett. Garrett, I am a Convel graduate, and I have three children coming up through the Convel system right now, two in middle school. And I would love to hear from you. How have students really helped you feel successful and be successful at Convel?
Abby, we lost your line a little bit. How have other students helped you feel successful at Convel? Is that what you asked? That's correct, Abby? Okay, thank you for the call. Go ahead, Garrett.
Well, Abby, I don't know if you can hear me, but just my experience being there 4 years was an unbelievable experience. Just the different classes that I take and so many different memories. My one advice is for your son or whatever, I don't know if he's attending or not, but he should really focus on doing work. It's going to pay off in the future. It certainly has for me, and it's continuing to do some good for me. So that's my advice to you.
And from the film, Garrett, I see you as a hard worker, but I also know that, you know, you do have these problems that you were born with. So how do you, what do you do when you get frustrated and it's just feels too hard?
Well, I remember we had a game. I'm on the Unified basketball team, like I said earlier. I had a game, and we were playing. I forgot we were playing, but anyway, I think we were winning at the time. And I was trying my best, hustling out there hard, just trying my best to help my team win. And I'm not going to say a particular student, but this particular student got frustrated easily. And I said, don't give up. Just pick your head up when you're down, and it's going to be all right. And I don't do that. I don't smack the floor and get all frustrated. And I just say, hey, we might lose the game, but at least we tried. That's the best you can do.
Garrett has a unique ability to kind of ignore a negative and look more positive. He seems to always pull a positive piece out of something that may be an uncomfortable experience, I think.
And I would say, like, in Garrett's case and also the other people that I featured on, and including Samuel, everyone brings this incredible value to their community. Garrett is one of the most positive social people I've ever met in my life. He just makes everyone feel better about themselves. How can that be measured, you know, through any assessment or standardized testing? In the film, I feature an artist named Nair, who's an incredible artist. You know, he brings his artwork. Micah has an incredible circle of friends and through his social media that he brings together. Naomi is a hard worker. So, you know, people bring this value that can't be measured through any standardized testing.
Let's go to another call. This is Cheryl in Kingston. Hi, Cheryl. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Laura.
Sure.
I am a teacher of students with disabilities, and I think one of your guests just made my point about there is no one size fits all, and that we have to make sure that pendulum doesn't swing all the way to one end or the other. Expectations are important to have high expectations, but if a student cannot meet them, if accommodations and modifications are not put into place, too many expectations can also be frustrating, and so it could have unintended consequences. So assessment is the key to find out where the student is and making an individualized education program to meet their needs.
Cheryl, thank you so much for the call. Marianne, your thoughts on what Cheryl said?
Oh, I agree totally. We always worked within the factor of Jesse's physical limitations, you know, and since he did not have cognitive limitations, those were the areas where we went. Physically, he was very, very limited. He only had a raking grasp, so we had to accommodate that. some of the stuff that we worked with, when Jesse first proved he could read to us, it was because we used an iGaze computer, which was a prototype at the time. We went to Boston College here, and they put electrodes around his eye, and his eye moved the cursor. And he was able to actually play a video game for the first time in his life and beat his dad. He was
very happy.
But what's great now, though, is it's no longer a prototype. It's for real. So that's an incredible thing that has happened. So that would be some supplementary of what the teacher was just talking about, that you would accommodate that, you know?
Dan, how has technology changed life for your own family?
Yeah, I was going to say technology.
It's been amazing,
it's such
hasn't
an exciting
it?
Time with technology. My son Samuel uses a communication device that's right in front of his wheelchair, and he can use his finger to go. And he has all his content vocabulary for classes, for physics, for sociology, for chemistry in his device. So when it comes up in class, he can talk about the elements. He can talk about the properties of physics. He can be assessed that way. But not only that, Micah, who's in my film, Intelligent Lives, he uses voice to text technology all the time. Micah doesn't read, but he's taking college classes at Syracuse University because he can speak to text and text can speak back to him. And what's wonderful is that now this technology is so mainstream that it doesn't make people feel different or unusual to have technology all around them. Every single person basically has a very high-powered computer in their pocket called the smartphone all the time. Well, so it's become mainstream.
And Garrett mentioned that he uses that to help him get around because he can't remember how to get places.
Definitely.
So describe the quantum leap, though, Dan, for your family, for your son, before he had this voice computer and after.
Right. Well, I can't imagine Samuel being as successful in school as he has been without the technology. And I think, again, but some of it is technology, but some of it is how people use the technology. What's really made Samuel successful at Concord High School is his general education teachers in history and all these classes getting the content vocabulary to him before it comes up in the class and then programming it into the device. And as I speak with people around the country, that's the biggest challenge, is the communication that families and schools have, the collaboration. And unfortunately, it becomes very antagonistic sometimes in some communities, but it can work so much more smoothly when we have open lines of communication and collaboration, which I'm thankful we've had, and I think Garrett's had at his school.
Well, I definitely want to ask you about that, Dan, for sure, because it's not always a perfect situation. But let's go back to our listeners who really want to join into our conversation. And Andre is calling from Peterborough. Hi, Andre. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Yeah. Hi. I was just wanted to say this is your friend from Conroe. And my question was to tell us about your ed class and our Unify championship that we had won last year.
Okay.
And we're proud of him too.
So this is Andre, and you're calling from Peterborough. You're a classmate of Garrett, Andre?
Yeah,
is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I'm classmate with him and best friends with him too.
Okay, awesome. And I'm guessing everybody's listening there right now in the classroom. Is that right?
Because
you should be in school, Andre. Just saying.
Yeah, we are. We were listening, yeah.
All right, well, stand by. Garrett, go ahead.
Well, I just feel tremendously blessed to have, Andres in my life, Dalton in my life, Dylan in my life, because if it wasn't for Andres, you know, reminding me every day what classes to go to, I wouldn't be here. So I thank him for doing this for me throughout these years.
Garrett, one of the really important parts of your story that I was able to film was the opportunity for you to do work and internships in high school. And it's shown that if a student with disabilities has some work experience in high school, they're about 70 to 75% likely to have paid employment as adults. If they don't have some work experience, it's maybe 20 or 25%. So I don't know if you want to mention the internship you did in the gym class with Sil. That was really great opportunity.
Yes, sir. Well, you make a great point, Dan, because I just love young kids. Kids, whether it's older or younger, I just love them because because you were in their shoes at one point in your life, and you get to see how they grow and see how they act, see how they transpire in the world, and that's been a real plus for me, and I hope to continue that in the future.
Yeah, so Garrett helped out at the gym class in the middle school as a mentor
right,
and as a teacher. So he's getting real life experience in his own school district in terms of future employment possibilities. Yeah.
So you talked about Concord, Dan, and Dan Shows and Garrett Shows have talked about Conval, but you alluded to this earlier, Dan, so let's talk about it. Marianne, you first. I mean, it's not always a perfect situation. I wonder how much you think your average school community, Marianne, you know, from the principal down to the student like Andre, who just called in, and thank you, Andre, how much do you think the average school views inclusion as a burden versus a benefit? What do you think, Marianne?
I don't know, because, I mean, understand, we're no longer in the trenches, and Jesse has been gone for 13 years. When we first moved here, I didn't even have the internet to research.
Wow.
All I knew was that Massachusetts had a better than the average federal average for inclusion, okay? And New York and New Jersey did not. New York and New Jersey had very low averages for that. So we moved here, you know, knowing that it was better, but we moved to the one town that did not have inclusion, and it was town by town. It was, even though it was on the books, the special ed director really determined whether or not full inclusion happened. What happened after I had to organize all the parents was we made sure to get a parent on the school board who had a child with a disability, because that voice was being unheard. You know, no one was hearing that voice. So we helped to affect change in our town. And basically, I do believe in grassroots, that you can affect change in that way. I remember when we were struggling, our lawyer said, well, why don't you move to Newton, which is where I grew up, which had full inclusion. I said, well, because we live here, and we actually want our kid to go to school here. So,
yeah, it's easy to say, you know, pick up and move, but it's, you know, it's not always something that's available to you. Can you talk about that, Dan Shows, as well, what it was like in Georgia when the school was not really equipped or welcoming, or however you want to phrase it?
This was very early on. We didn't know what we were facing with Garrett coming out of the hospital, but we knew the schools, as we started to do some research, had no inclusion, and that was one thing that we felt very strongly about. I'm 53. I had no disabled kids in my class when I was growing up. I had no experience with them whatsoever. I'm discovering that now as a parent, as an adult. There's no one, as a human, you're not going to go through life without experiencing someone that has a disability, either a relative, a family member, or someone that you're going to come in contact with. These kids at Conval, due to the inclusion program that they have there and that they have in other schools, will have a leg up on how to interact with and include these students and these prospective adults going forward. And it's helped the program with the unified sports program that they started at the high school. Andre's alluded to it before. They won the state championship last year. That program has grown exponentially, which includes players and partners from the school. It's an integration of students that play a competitive sport.
And it's really fun to watch on the film, to watch you guys play. Here's speaking to the point of, you know, you had no experience with this, Dan, and I know, Dan, that was your experience, too, before you had Samuel. And one of you guys said earlier that people in the disability community call the rest of us temps because eventually something's going to happen. Got an email toward that effect from Mark, who says, early in August last year, I was bitten by a tick. Within 3 weeks, Mark says, I was a quadriplegic. Wow. Mark says, I had to consciously learn how to do everything again. This included speech therapy. Mark says, it was a true eye-opener. I'm still getting PT, but have mostly recovered. I am truly one of the luckiest people alive. Mark says, so to any listener who thinks it could never happen to you, it is only one tick bite away. Wow, Mark, thank you so much for that email. We will talk a lot more after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. This hour, we're looking at the themes raised in two films about people with intellectual disabilities, documentaries which challenge the way our society defines intelligence. Send us an email with your questions and comments and personal experiences, of course, with this. exchange@nhpr.org is the email. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have four guests to talk about this. Dan Habib is here, a filmmaker for UNH's Institute on Disability, creator of the award-winning documentaries, including Samuel, Who Cares About Kelsey, and Mr. Connolly Has ALS. And we're also talking about Dan's brand new film called Intelligent Lives. Marianne Leone is also with us. She's executive producer for Intelligent Lives and author of the 2010 book Jesse, A Mother's Story About Her Son, who had cerebral palsy and epilepsy. Garrett Shows is with us. He's a student at Conval High School. He's profiled in an earlier film by Dan with a similar theme. Garrett serves on the Student Principal Advisory Committee, participates in Unified Sports, works part-time at Shaw's. Also, Dan Shows is with us. He's Garrett Shows' father, and the family lives in Peterborough. One more time, that number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Nancy that came in from Putney, who says, I am the parent of a profoundly deaf daughter who has had a number of completely insane test results, including an IQ test that indicated she should have trouble dressing herself. Nancy says she is now a college grad who's about to enter a Smith College master's degree program. Wow, Nancy, I love that story. And Dan, in your film, the thing that was interesting for me was it's a lot of your earlier films have focused on kids in high school. This film focuses on young adults making that transition to college, to work, and so forth. So how is that sort of different or an extension of the story that you've been telling for a while?
Right. So kudos to Nancy and her family. And it just shows the power of high expectations versus low expectations. I think that should be the common theme. You know, as Samuel gets older, he's 18 now, I'm thinking a lot more about his transition. So it got me thinking a lot about this age range. And as I started to think about the film Intelligent Lives, I thought about, well, there's different places where we need to be focusing on. High school, many times inclusion just falls off. People think, oh, well, it can't happen in high school. So I made sure to go to an incredible public high school in Boston, the Henderson School, and find Nair Shahid, who's fully included in school despite having significant emotional challenge, behavioral challenges and verbal challenges. He's an incredible artist. Then I wanted to show that in college, people can go to college now with all kinds of disabilities, including intellectual disabilities. There's an incredible network called the Think College Network of almost 300 universities around the country that are now have particular opportunities for students with intellectual disability. And I went to Syracuse University to film Micah Fialka-Feldman, who is co-teaching college class, taking college classes, has an incredible circle of friends, was given an IQ of 40 when he was a kid. So he's one of my other themes in the film. And then in terms of the workplace, Naomi Montplaisir is a young woman of Haitian descent living in Providence, Rhode Island. She has Down syndrome. She, unfortunately, in high school was in such a segregated setting, it was actually serving as a sheltered workshop, meaning it was this segregated place where high school students were asked to do menial tasks like put jewelry together that was then being sold and they weren't seeing a dime of it. This was such an egregious case, and this was only like 5-6 years ago that they were sued. Rhode Island was sued by the U.S. Department of Justice. And now I film Naomi transitioning to paid integrated employment. So these are critical institutions in our society that need to be inclusive. And I tried to show the three stories in film Intelligent Lives.
Well, and let's talk a little bit about Naomi, because we talked earlier about these institutions and we all think, oh, 1950s, 60s, you know, how terrible. But as you point out in the film, this Harold Birch School in Rhode Island, you know, was just exposed a couple years ago. Let's hear a little bit from the film. This is attorney Eve Hill with the U.S. Department of Justice. She talks about her work exposing what was going on at the Harold Birch School in Providence.
The Harold Birch Vocational School struck us as the height of segregation and low expectations. Their curriculum was placing jewelry on cardboard instead of math, instead of science, instead of reading. This agreement. In April of 2014, we reached a settlement agreement with the state of Rhode Island to transform that system to one that prioritized and relied primarily on competitive integrated employment.
So again, that is Eve talking about the Harold Birch School, which, you know, opened my eyes, Dan, that this stuff still goes on.
Yeah, and this idea that Eve talks about competitive integrated employment, it's kind of a wonky term, but it basically means you're applying for a job, it's integrated in regular society, and it's employment. And like Garrett's experience at Shaw's in Peterborough is a perfect example of a regular job. I don't know if you want to talk about that at all, Garrett.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. It's amazing because I've worked for Shaw's for at least 2 years now, about 2 years, and I love it. I love dressing myself every day, getting my work uniform on every day, driving to work, clocking in every day, and actually doing real work. I just love it, and you'd be surprised because I've seen Andres there a few times, so many of my friends a few times. The other day I saw one of my friends, some adults I've seen, just random adults saying, a random adult approached me at work, and he said, "Are you Garrett Shaw's?" And I was like, "Yes, sir, I am." And he just said, and I'll never forget this, it was insane, because he said, you're one of the most hardest workers I've ever seen at Shaw's. And I was like, and thank you very much. I take my job very, very seriously.
Well, Dan's film talks about, again, because it's the stars of the show, the three of them are really kind of people your age, yeah. You know, 18, 19, 20. And two of them do aspire to go to college. I wonder if you want to go to college, Garrett.
Yes, I am. That's a huge goal of mine. A huge goal of mine is to be independent. So whatever that takes. So I've been saving up some money. I looked online how many dollars do you have to go to UNH. And like I said in my film, I'm saving the money and I'm still saving it. It's a lot of money, but I'm getting there.
So what are your thoughts on that, Dad?
In regards to the job, when Garrett was 16, he kept telling us that he wanted to apply for the job. He'd see the hiring sign out there, and we didn't understand what the process would be, so we said, all right, go in and apply for it. He walked in off the street. I'm not sure they realized who they were getting when they got Garrett. You know, it takes a little bit of time with him once you get, but the benefits they've seen from him socially and how he deals with their customers there, I think he's become a real asset. The transition after Garrett graduates, if he stays one additional year at the school to gain more skills at Conval, that's our next big step, to try to find a program where he can gain more technical skills to help him be a more productive member of our society. He's highly motivated, and he wants to be independent.
Well, and here's an email that just came in from Gloria. As a frequent shopper at Shaw's in Peterborough, I am so impressed with Garrett when I see him at work. He's always so friendly and diligent and makes my day. Gloria says, I'm also the girls' tennis coach at Conval, and our team is riding the bus to Manchester today with the Unified Track team. After today's program, I'm really excited about that. Well, Gloria, thank you for jumping in. And I wonder, Marianne, what about work? I mean, there's been so much attention these days and during our show today about school and making schools integrated and so forth. But I wonder what your thoughts are about, you know, young adults moving into the workplace.
Well, I'm not the right person to ask, since Chris and I are both artists, and you know we're like used to being unemployed. We spent a lot of our time as starving artists, living in a six-floor walk-up in Hell's Kitchen, figuring out like how we were going to work. And my husband actually is a master carpenter, and I started out writing copy for MGM, but. We were thinking that Jesse would go to college too, and we figured he'd follow in the family business and be a writer because he wrote a lot of poetry. And, you know, it is hard to get gainful employment in the arts, but it seemed that that's the way he was going. So as far as, you know, we've all had sustenance jobs, and I think we would have probably had Jesse maybe do something in line with his passion for writing.
And my idea is just follow your bliss, whether or not you are, you know, you have disabilities to overcome. It's all about getting paid for what you love to do eventually.
I think that's exactly what I was thinking, Marianne, is the fact that we want options for our kids. We want options as our very young adults. And the fact that Garrett may choose to go to college, he may choose to go into the workforce. You know, Samuel is starting to now think about community college classes next year. He wants to be a filmmaker, kind of like his dad. But I think, I believe that people with disabilities should have the same rights and access to college opportunities as people without disabilities. And I'm excited to hear that there are some things happening in the state right now, some conversations going on to try and create more and more access for people with disabilities within the UNH system as well, and I'm really excited about that.
Well, and in the film, Dan, the young woman featured, so there's two young men, Micah and Nair. The young woman featured, Naomi, as you mentioned earlier, she gets a job at a beauty salon. How does that happen?
Well, you know, one of the things that happened for Naomi was she's working with a job training program in Rhode Island that was very intentional about giving her job trials in different environments. And at first, she was at this kiosk trying to make change for people, sell goods at the State House. You know, she has tremendous challenges with math. They realized that wasn't a good fit. Then she went to Empire Beauty School, one of the most diverse and vibrant work environments I've ever been in, just ethnically and in every way it was diverse and energized. And she's such a social and kind of tactile person. It was a great fit for her. And I think what I saw with Naomi, what I saw with Garrett at Shaw's, the workplace is part of our community. And we all need communities to be a part of. When you're in school, you have this kind of built-in community of school. But I'm nervous for Samuel and for other kids. When they leave school, what's their community going to be? I don't want them to feel alienated or isolated. You know, Garrett was a perfect example of all the people he bumps into at Shaw's. Naomi walks into Empire Beauty School. She has this feeling of community. So the work is certainly about money. It's about a sense of identity and self-determination. But it's also a sense of having another community where you can develop friendships and passions.
Well, that's the thing, too. And again, a lot of the films and a lot of our conversation is focused on schools and what are they doing and so forth. But you're right, Dan. I mean, the outside world is kind of a whole nother ball of wax.
Exactly. And I think, again, when it comes back to college, I mean, college for me was a really incredible time in my life of building community, creating new friendships. You know, I think to deprive students with disabilities of that opportunity to develop the kind of social connections and experiences of college, it's a really big loss for people to not have that opportunity.
Go ahead, Dan.
I was going to say, you know, this demographic has a built-in societal cost because of government and federal support, entitlements, and benefits. And we're just now getting to the beginning of being able to extract and enhance the talents from these people. You know, these people have skills that have not been tapped, and our society is not benefiting from this cost. Mm-hmm. And it allows them to grow as individuals, develop independency. And we can harness their skills if we can find programs to help them transition to enhance those skills.
Well, and that's a key word. You said society sees it right now still as a cost, and we're just now starting to see the benefits.
That's correct.
And when I saw Garrett working with the kids in his film, when I saw Naomi, you know, making the customers feel happy, helping the beauticians out, you know, you see that role. Go ahead, Dan.
I saw a special not long ago. I can't remember the software company that did this, but they were having trouble filling high-end programming positions. So they had to look outside the box and open up their job applicant program, and they took very high-functioning autistic people who could deal with code. And because our unemployment rate is so low right now, companies are having trouble finding employees to fill these positions. Well, these people who end up being one of the best employers because they stay, they don't call in sick, and they love the work, and they can do the work. These skills need to be discovered, and they need to be enhanced. And we need programs that help these kids transition to be able to discover what those are and to bolster them going forward.
I'm really interested in what you said, Dan, about, you know, we look so much at the cost. We don't look, you know, people in this room excluded, but we don't look at the benefits. And Marianne, you know, your husband in the film is quite moving about how your son, Jesse, and again, I'm sorry for your loss. I didn't say that earlier. How he benefited everybody he came in contact with. Chris is pretty eloquent about that, and I wonder if you could just share that with us.
I really am still amazed at it's like a ripple effect, and I know that his two best friends, Kyle, who he met in middle school, and Jamie, who was his girlfriend, she is teacher. She teaches music now. But Kyle, who befriended this kid who basically, you know, Jesse was without words except through his computer, he is someone who studies languages. He's about to get his PhD in languages. And they communicated, and he affected Kyle very strongly. And I still run into kids who went to school with him, who I think it just opens up your... I wish I had gone to school with people of different abilities, but that did not happen. I didn't meet people of differing abilities until I was an adult. And I think it seriously benefits society. I told a story in the book about when Chris was filming The Bourne Identity. We took Jesse to watch him film. And when we were coming back, we went through Paris, and we were having trouble catching a connecting flight because everything was out of order. For all the elevators were out of order. Everything was je suis désolé. So Chris finally got really mad and put Jesse onto the escalator, but what we didn't realize was that there were barricades at the top. And it was like,
oh, no.
And
he was in a pretty serious wheelchair. Yeah.
And he had a travel chair, but he wrote about it for his class because he was keeping a journal on his computer. And his teacher very wisely said, okay, they want to hold the Olympics in France. So to whom would you, she was teaching them how to write letters to people to get what you want. And to whom would you write a letter about this? And she sent us the letters that the class wrote. So these are all like 10-year-olds, right? And they're like, one kid wrote, dear Mr. Bush, do you know what happened to my friend Jesse? But my favorite was the fact that here was a classroom of 10-year-olds now thinking about, some kids were writing, well, what about parents with children in strollers? And what about elderly people? So now these 10-year-olds are all thinking of community because they have Jesse in the class. That was really a big lesson.
That's the opening that you're saying happens. And Dan, I'll throw the last question to you. So Concord debut, New Hampshire debut, this film in Concord on Monday. Just kind of give us the quick 411 on that.
Marianne and Chris Cooper are going to be there. So if you want to meet two incredible people who are also incredible actors and well-known, they're going to be there, as well as Nair and Micah. So at 5 o'clock, we're doing a reception at the Capitol Center for the Arts. And then at 6:30 is the screening. So if you go to our website, intelligentlives.org, you can get all the information about how to attend that. And we already have hundreds of people coming. We welcome everyone to come to this event.
Okay. Well, all of you, thank you for being here. And Marianne, it was really nice to have you on the air. Thank you.
Oh, thanks very much.
All right. Hope you have a good trip to Concord on Monday. That's Marianne Leone, executive producer of Intelligent Lives. Garrett and Dan Shows, it was really good to meet you, too. Thank you for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
And Dan Habib, thank you also for your time.
We appreciate
it.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.